Hello there. What up? What up? Welcome to another episode of the Imperial Security Bureau podcast, where we interview leaders in cybersecurity and AI. Today, I'm excited about our guest. Oh, you're going to love it. We're diving deep into AI. We've got Robert Daigle. Here he is, my man. This is his LinkedIn, if you're listening. Robert Daigle, the Director of Global AI Business for Lenovo. We got a fellow Raleigh, North Carolinian here. I'm excited to get some local folks on the podcast. And we have mutual friends in my neighborhood. We'll chat about that. Robert has been in AI for over 10 years. He is a top AI voice on LinkedIn. He does public speaking. He goes to a ton of tech conferences and such. So I'm excited to have him on. ECU graduate, MBA, go Pirates. My dad went to ECU, so I like ECU. Business consulting for a while, was a senior AI manager for a recruiting company in 2014 to 2016. That was began his career in AI. Then he was a marketing lead for Brightly, and has been with Lenovo now for 7 years, moving up through the ranks. We're going to dive in. We're probably going to have a part two because an hour and a half flew by. I mean, it was in a flash, but hope you guys enjoy. Here we go. Let's chat with Robert. Well, all right. Welcome to the podcast. Robert, how are you, sir?
Doing awesome, Blake. Thanks so much for having me, man. I'm excited to talk about one of my favorite topics, artificial intelligence. So really excited to be here and jump into it.
One of mine too, my friend. And just a little backstory so the audience knows how we got connected. We met at a neighbor's housewarming party. There's a lot of people in my neighborhood that work at Lenovo. So I was strolling to the kitchen looking for something to eat there. They had a big spread. And here you are holding a baby, and your spouse was holding a baby too. And I was like, wait a minute, they've got twins. I know this man's pain right here because I have twins too. So it was an instant brotherhood there. It was good to meet you that day. I think we talked in the kitchen for a good hour.
Yeah, man. You can tell the twin dads are the ones with the dark circles under their eyes, you know, so they're always easy to spot in a crowd.
Yeah, man. Just survive. If you can survive the first 18 months with twins, you can survive anything, my friend.
That's right. That's right. But it's fun. It's been a fun time. They're 9 months old already, so it's been flying by. Just watching them grow. There's ebbs and flows to it. You know, it's like we're going through a little regression right now, a little sleep regression. So they're back to waking up every 3 hours or so. But, you know, it comes and goes. So
I feel for you, man. I remember those days. I've got good sleepers, and we've always had some pretty good sleepers. So very blessed in that regard. I don't know if I would have survived it if not. But every 2 or 3 months, you'll enter a new phase. You'll be like, oh, okay, we're doing this now. Okay, yeah, this is cool. But just when you think you have everything figured out, nope, new phase.
Yep. It's always changing. And you got two of them, so they don't always keep the same pace either. So if you have a singleton, right, you know, it's like it's always changing, but you know, you kind of adapt to the new normal. When you got two of them, it's like one of them's gonna like be hitting different milestones at different times, and they don't always, it's not always one leading the milestones. It's like they kind of like leapfrog each other, so you never know what you're gonna get. It's like every day is a kind of new experience. I was talking to my wife this morning. She's like, they won't nap for more than 15 minutes a day, and yesterday one of them napped for almost 3 hours. So it's like you just don't know what you're gonna get.
Yeah, the struggle is real, my friend. So Godspeed to you. But yeah, a couple of warm-up questions, and I used to do this, I got away from it, but I want to get back to it before we dive into all the AI stuff. And I can't wait to talk to you about that, by the way. You've got an incredible background in that space, and I've been excited about this conversation for a while. But tell me, just to get to know you a little bit better, what's your favorite movie and who's your favorite band?
Those are good ones to start out with. You know, I would say like favorite movie of all time. You know, for some reason, I always, like when I was younger, I always watched the Ocean's 11 movie.
Look, just out of curiosity, which casinos did you geniuses pick to rob?
Bellagio.
It's the Bellagio, the Mirage, and the MGM Grand.
Those are Terry Benedict's casinos.
That was like classic favorite. Yeah, I've got others throughout the years that I kind of gravitated towards, but I used to have that on VHS, man. So, and I used to burn that one up. I mean, it's the one movie I watched probably the most, like over and over again.
You think we need one more? You think we need one more? All right, we'll get one more.
My wife, she probably watched Titanic or something over and over again. I watched Ocean's 11. That was my go-to. And then favorite band of all time. Man, that's a tough one. Over the years, I've gone through so many different phases of music. My taste in music and my preferences changed throughout the years. One of the ones that I still brush the dust off the CD or pull it up on an old Spotify playlist is Anne Berlin. Classic early 2000s band. It really brings me back to my angst youth days. One of my favorites. It's also a good, they got some good like high intensity songs. So if you're going to the gym, you need to get hyped up, you know, get some momentum going into the gym. I still pull out some Anne Berlin tracks from time to time. Another band, Need to Breathe. Let's have a great night. On the dance floor, I'll be the cowboy. Went through a phase where I was felt like a Need to Breathe groupie anytime they came to North Carolina. I was going to be at that concert. So those are some of the ones that I've gravitated to over the years. And then like just kind of all kinds of new music. I've kind of gotten into like almost like electronic, almost EDM type pop music phase for a while. So lots of different bands I listened to there. So I'm all over the place, man. I still listen to bluegrass, country. I'm not too picky when it comes to genres.
Very cool. Yeah, I wasn't expecting that. And I've never heard of those two bands that you mentioned, so I'll have to check those out. But yeah, as far as the EDM space, it's easier to get in the flow state whenever you listen to music without words in it. Also like funk, like the Memphis rap that's kind of muffled out. It's Memphis rap with techno, basically.
Interesting.
Yeah, I like working to that. I kind of get in the groove. Hours go by and you're just like, oh my God, I got all kinds of stuff done.
Flow state music. There's this, the genre's lo-fi.
Oh yeah.
I think there's this one called Fruity Loops. It is like no words. They do a lot of remixes of like the tune is kind of like some song you've probably heard of. It's no words, slower lo-fi stuff. And it is just great, you know, kind of getting in the zone, getting in flow state. And it's interesting, like once you get your go-to like flow state music, you can just, you turn it on, you lock in. It's like it kind of pre-wires your brain. Like you program yourself to respond to that music of like, I've got to focus and get some stuff done.
Yeah. What was strange though, is I was listening to the Lex Fridman podcast and he claims that he's more productive listening to brown noise. Like it's weird. It's like stuff that you would put on to help your babies go to sleep. I don't understand that.
Brown noise, I'm out, man. We've got a noise machine for the twins. When that thing's rolling, I'm done, man. It puts me to sleep about as fast as it puts them to sleep, which can be dangerous sometimes. But I would get no work done if I did that.
Yeah, sleep when the babies sleep. It's easier said than done. People always tell you that, but it's like, okay, yeah. This is my time to get some stuff done right now. I can't.
That's right.
Well, tell us, man. Let's go back. What's the short story? Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah. So I can start kind of early on. I grew up in Arkansas, moved to North Carolina when I was pretty young. Went to school here in North Carolina, East Carolina University for undergrad. Even went back for grad school. So I've been around North Carolina for a long time, moved to Raleigh for work after I graduated from East Carolina with my undergrad program, and actually started out working on some different marketing roles. And then after I finished up my MBA, I landed at the startup that was doing behavior pattern analytics for recruiters in an applicant tracking system. And it was early stage, you know, maybe we had 40 employees total at the time. A lot of it was focused on development engineering. So our like go-to-market team was like 5 people. So pretty small. So I started out doing marketing for them. And one of the things that we like, as startups do, you go through pivots, you look at kind of how the market's responding. Everyone thought we had really cool tech, but no one wanted to switch their applicant tracking system over because they get embedded with their ATS system. And they have all these integrations, all that kind of stuff. So we had to kind of reinvent ourselves and look at a new way of doing things. And that's when big data was still pretty popular and kind of like everyone was talking about how you use big data. And so I dug into this a little bit and, you know, was talking with our CEO about it. And our hypothesis was, could we use big data and use machine learning to do candidate prediction rather than looking at the recruiter behavior and what led to a successful placement? Could we look at the candidate's profile and understand who's the right fit for a role based off of their resume or their profile? And so we actually analyzed a couple million records and started developing algorithms. And at the time, you know, when we came up with this, like one of the like Skunkworks AI team or data science teams that we wanted to build out to work on some of these projects, like, you know, predicting candidate fit, our founder was like, all right, Rob, you had this idea, go hire a data scientist. I'm like, I mean, I don't know how to hire a data scientist. I don't know it, you know, other than just kind of Googling. That was my experience and knowledge in data science and AI at the time. And this has been like a decade ago. So AI wasn't a prominent topic. It wasn't a field where you know, where it's so popular as it is today, where kind of everyone's an AI expert. But Googling and kind of understanding, you know, what it would take to build this type of model and these type of solutions into our application. So I kind of expanded into, I was leading marketing, leading front-end development, and then I had this kind of added responsibility of standing up a Skunkworks data science team in the organization. And then, so I had to know enough to interview data scientists and know if they knew what they were talking about. So it required a little bit of self-upskilling and kind of training myself up on the topic. And then once we brought on, you know, some data scientists and engineers, learning from them and kind of learning how they were, you know, trying to go through and build models to analyze, you know, the data that we had that we could drive insights from. So that was really where I got into AI about 10 years ago. So that's my story in like, what is it, 3 minutes, 4 minutes?
I like it. And so we've got similar backgrounds. You may have been in recruiting around the same time that I started, I guess, but I have to check the dates on that. You're describing software that I kind of wish I had right now. A lot of ATS systems claim to be good at, you know, this analyzing of resumes and such, and I haven't found them to be that great. I mean, they're okay. They're getting better, but what came of that? Did you guys sell it to someone else or?
They're still running. They're still up and running. It's a company in North Carolina called LeoForce.
Oh, okay.
The app
yeah.
that I worked on is called Aria, which is the sourcing agent. It was funny. At the time, we were having this whole debate on, like, there was an opinion that we call it a recruiting robotics tool, uh-huh. right? It didn't really sound, you know, because RPA was getting pretty popular in that space, in the analytics space, so robotics process automation. So it was like, oh, we should call it a recruiting robotics tool. And I was like, what about an AI sourcing agent? So we used that. We landed on that. And then we went to HR Tech, the big, you know, HR Tech conference. And we were like the only AI company there, right? And now if I walked into HR Tech, I haven't been in a few years, but it's probably like every booth has AI plastered on it, you know?
Everything.
It's just, you know, the market's changed quite a bit. And there are a lot of companies that are going after, like, can we bolt on some AI to our application to improve the performance of it, to provide better candidate fit for job requisitions? So there's a lot of, like, the traditional IT companies out there in every industry, not just in HR tech, but in every industry that are trying to bolt on some AI widget or AI module to serve customers and improve the experience of their customers. But then there's a whole ecosystem of startups that are essentially like building really cool tech to integrate into those traditional IT systems. And so that's really where we see a lot of innovation coming from, is that startup community building some really cool technology, really cool applications. And, you know, one of our strategies at Lenovo is to be their best partner, right? That's what we do through our Lenovo AI Innovators program, is try to be the best partner for some of these software applications that our customers are looking at and considering using in their IT environment.
Nice. Back to the Aria tool, that reminded me, because I did discover that online. I was like, wait a minute, this could be huge. So I sent in a request for a demo. And at the time, I think it was so early that even the owner of the company, or the main architect of the product, he came to visit our office on site. And I mean, it was a great presentation, but the IT guys at our corporate headquarters were calling me. They're like, whoa, what's going on at your office? We've got something like calling outside the network. And I'm like, well, this guy here doing a demo. I was like, man, did he just swipe our whole candidate database just like that? But yeah, and he didn't, right? I couldn't convince the team to buy it, but it did seem super cool to have like that AI agent go out and do sourcing on your behalf. Yeah, I guess it works. They're still around. Back to Lenovo, because I did want to chat a lot about that. Where does Lenovo fit into the whole AI ecosystem right now?
You know, it's really interesting that what a lot of people don't realize is Lenovo has focused on this market and has been investing in this market since 2017. You know, we were supporting customers that were utilizing artificial intelligence before that. That's when we really said, you know what, this is something that's going to be a major, major change in the IT industry. We didn't know exactly when the market was going to pop, but we knew it was a market where we wanted to incubate and invest in. And so back in 2017, our CEO, YY, committed like $1.2 billion investment into AI, edge computing, and a few of these incubation businesses. And essentially, that was the funding that founded the team I'm on now at Lenovo. And I was privileged to be like one of the third hire for the AI team at Lenovo once they founded it in 2017. So we've been in this space for a long time. You know, it's changed quite a bit. When I started, there was, most of our customers were doing research, like enabled by artificial intelligence. Like they were big HPC centers, high performance computing centers, or research centers, or research universities that were like buying some GPUs, or at the time, still a lot of machine learning workloads running on CPUs to start infusing AI, like machine learning, deep learning models in traditional areas of research. That was one way that we saw them adopting it. And the other thing was HPC centers started having to support researchers that were like really data scientists, you know, so a different type of user. So there's like software tools that we developed. One of them was a platform called Leco AI platform. It was designed to essentially give a cluster. And when we say cluster, we're talking about a supercomputer that's basically a bunch of individual servers that are networked together to work as one computer. So they could do things like train these really big models and do research that, you know, what we believed is research that helps solve some of humanity's greatest challenges. And that was really the focus of our business at the time, back in 2017 when we launched. And so it was really stuff that was close to the infrastructure, GPUs in the data center, you know, high-speed networking, and then some software tools to make the environment easier to use for data scientists and researchers that were starting to train models and use AI within their traditional areas of research. And that could range from like, you know, weather forecasting to genomics analysis to computational fluid dynamics. Those are all the traditional kind of areas of our traditional HPC and research workloads that we're starting to see AI be infused in those to provide better outputs in those areas of research. It changed a lot, right? So, you know, around like 2019 or so, about 2019, we started seeing more enterprise interest in AI. And I would say that's when the market really started. Of course, you're going to have some companies out there, like in financial services, that have been using machine learning for years to do algorithmic trading and AML use cases and all kinds of stuff they've been doing for years. But really, we started seeing the broader enterprise market start to, you know, uptick in 2019. And we kicked off a project, a case study that we have with Kroger. That's one of our big retail customers at Lenovo. We've got a public case study about how they're using AI and computer vision in the store. It's really cool. So we start seeing these types of opportunities pop up. And so we refocused our team to start focusing more on enterprise AI, building out partnerships that would be conducive for that market. And then, of course, 2023, generative AI booms. And of course, everyone's wanting to get into the game and start using artificial intelligence. So I think we were poised really well for that. But it really starts at the infrastructure, what Lenovo's doing. It starts at the infrastructure layer. We call it our hybrid AI strategy. And it means that we need to provide the right compute from devices to the data center to all, you know, everything in between to support AI workloads, whether it's, you know, an inferencing workload on your mobile phone or on your PC, or training one of the largest large language models on liquid-cooled supercomputers. We have to provide the right infrastructure, the management software and tools to make it easier to use that infrastructure, and then partnering with the right software providers, whether they're the big Red Hats of the world and IBMs of the world, or, you know, the ISVs, the independent software vendors that are building really cool tech, you know, startups and ISVs in our innovators program. And then, of course, we launched our professional services practice for AI last year. So actually doing full end-to-end services for AI. So really broad, you know, and you ask, like, what's Lenovo doing in AI? It's hardware, software, services. It's, you know, everything from devices, Motorola phones, embedding AI into those devices all the way up to the data center. So really exciting stuff.
Nice. Yeah, I was talking to another friend of mine, and he also works at Lenovo and the product team, and he was talking to me about the new laptops and how it's not just a CPU anymore, right? There's like PCIe accelerators and CPUs and GPUs, yeah, and now NPUs. And so, like, under the hood of your laptop now, there's multiple processing units. What are the difference in those, and how does an NPU now fit into the device?
Yeah, well, I mean, really, we've seen this before. It's not necessarily a new thing. I think what's new is starting to take some of this technology and either expose it for more types of AI workloads, or, you know, bringing things that may have only existed in big supercomputing centers or in large clusters, and bring that type of technology down into devices that support enterprise workloads. One of the things I do in Lenovo as a hobby or a side project is we have an accelerator valuation steering committee. So basically, like, we're looking at new accelerator technology that's coming out, and like understanding what's coming in the market that may be a few years out from things that people are using today. So this idea of the AI coprocessor has been around for some time. A lot of them are based on ASICs or NPUs. But if you think about it, like, all compute has been focused on the CPU. When you design a server, when you design a laptop, when you design anything, it's typically designed around the CPU. And that central processing unit is really a general purpose compute. You can run all types of workloads on it. And that's the point of the CPU. But with being general purpose, you don't necessarily have the best performance for every workload. And so what happened in the market is you had GPUs, or graphic processing units, that were typically used for visualization, for gaming. Well, these do really well at parallel processing, which is, you know, the type of processing using graphics, but also the type of processing you need for neural networks and deep learning and AI, right? And so that's where kind of NVIDIA became the dominant player in this market, is like, they happen to have great technology that worked for AI workloads. And then, you know, their investment into the ecosystem of working with universities, and also their software teams in NVIDIA have been able to build up great stacks and optimize the software to run AI workloads and improve performance on it on GPUs. And that's really what set them apart, of them transitioning, you know, from a really what we thought of as a graphics company into an AI company, which has been really cool to see that transition. But even GPUs today are still a general purpose AI processor, right? They have a lot of different types of cores on them to support different visualization workloads, different AI workloads, even some of them that do double precision, like accelerating machine learning or high performance computing workloads. So they're still more general purpose. So if you look at CPUs being very general purpose, GPUs being a little more specialized, then you have like these ASICs and FPGA and other types of silicon NPUs that are dedicated AI coprocessors. They're not as general purpose. They don't have as good as software tools built around them, but some of them are much more efficient running some of these AI workloads than some of the general purpose stuff. And I know we're kind of going down a little bit more of a technical track, but as far as getting something that's much more efficient and maybe more price performant, things like NPUs are really attractive. They're not great for training AI models yet, but they're really great for deploying the stage we call inferencing, which is deploying AI models. They're really efficient. And some of these types of processors have been embedded into devices you already use and probably don't even realize it, either on the main processing unit as a separate core or as a separate chip in the box. But we've been using AI in our devices for years, and people probably don't even realize it. when you get on your phone and you start typing in something and it predicts the next word or phrase, it's using an AI model to do that prediction, right? To do that autocomplete prediction. And if you notice, the more you use your phone, the more it starts predicting words that you would typically use. Like, even if you're using slang or jargon or misspelled words, it adapts to that. And that's called federated learning. So people have been using federated learning on their mobile devices for years. And there's processing cores on the device to run these workloads that have been on the device for years. People really just haven't been, I think, too aware to it. But also those processing units have been tied to very, very specific workloads. And I think what's changing with, like, you know, the AI PC and some of the other AI devices that are coming out is we're opening up and we're exposing those AI processors. Well, A, we're adding more powerful AI processors onto the device, but then we're also exposing it to run other types of workloads. So if you think of like Copilot Plus, right, that's going to be the main driver of AI PC adoption. But then Lenovo has another application called AI Now, where you can use a chat interface and you can run a 7 billion parameter Llama 3 large language model on your device, which is really crazy, on the MPU, and still get really great battery life. You know, you don't have to have, you know, this huge power supply, or it doesn't burn up your battery. And that's because of that really efficient silicon on the MPU chip. So that's going to happen at the edge, at the device level, but also in the data center too. We're going to start seeing that shift to more efficient silicon in the data center to run AI workloads. And that's kind of the maturity curve that compute for AI is going to go through.
It's wild. Yeah, I've got a 4-year-old computer here, and I've got a 2-year-old like gaming computer over here. And then, you know, my phone, I'm an Android person, and it's coming up on 2 years on my phone. But I feel like, you know, it might be time to upgrade because some of the new hardware coming out is insane. I mean, it used to be like, yeah, I got a quad core, octa core, blah, blah, blah with a mid-level graphics card. But now it's like, wait, well, you don't even have an MPU on your machine, right? You don't have PCIe accelerators. So you're going to get left in the dust. It's time to upgrade.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's funny because I upgraded my work laptop last year. And then they released the new MPU-based one the year after. And I was like, oh, man, if I waited one more year, it would have been crazy. Because I use Copilot, right, in my work. And to run Copilot, it has to use a cloud instance of Copilot. But on the AI PC with the MPU, it's going to run some of those workloads to run Copilot on the device, which means it doesn't have to always be connected to the internet to use some of the functionalities of Copilot, stuff like that. So, you know, it's really cool. And then all the new applications that are kind of come out, if you think of like the lag time when we release a new technology into the market and then the lag time for startups to build really cool tech around it, it's going to take a year or 2 years for us to see some of these really cool applications come out. There's going to be a whole cohort of new applications that just weren't possible to run on your PC before because there wasn't an MPU, there wasn't the AI processing power on it. So there's going to be this whole new ecosystem of software solutions that come out for your PC over the next few years, this paradigm shift in technology.
Wow. Yeah. And so OpenAI, they released their voice model, right, where it's like you can have the voice live, right? And all these agents are going to come out now. And I feel like it's going to have a big impact on recruiting and interviewing, even more than it already has. It's a little scary and exciting at the same time. But even the, you know, the web-based AI platforms that you would have to call, they seem like fast enough. Like, but then when you bring it down to your machine, where it's not calling anything, it's happening right on your machine, is that type of speed really necessary? Like, it's already instant. You know?
Yeah. Well, I think the other aspect is that I don't think performance is the only driver anymore for why you would make some of these decisions. I've been working in this space for some time, and a few years ago, if I had a customer come in and they were making a decision on like, are we going to use this cloud application or are we going to run this on-prem in our own data center? A lot of the deciding factors around costs and like the price performance of like, how much is it going to cost me to run this in the cloud? You know, how much is it going to cost me to run it on-prem or run it locally? I think the factor now that most people are, and I think this is what generative AI has really brought into the limelight, is around data security and data sovereignty, right? Of who owns my data and who has access and rights to use my data. And especially in the corporate environment, enterprise environment, you have sensitive customer data. Some of that you want to do data mining and use things like generative AI tools to improve your workflow for some things you're doing. Maybe it's like understanding trends and, you know, unstructured data sets that you have today. Now, you have the cost factor of, if I want to do that today and I'm going to use some cloud environment, I have to move all of that data. It's probably sitting in some storage in my data center and I have to move it into the cloud. So there's the ingress, egress cost. There's the data storage in the cloud cost, and then the additional cost of compute in the cloud versus on-prem. And so that's like understanding the cost factor. But really, I think what's driving a lot of people to repatriate their infrastructure back on-prem, bring some of their workloads back on-prem, is this move to generative AI, because there's been so many instances of data leakage with using large language models by cloud vendors that a lot of people are, they're excited about it, but they're also scared to be able to just throw their data in the cloud because there's been like proprietary code that gets leaked out, ChatGPT and other large language models. And the really cool thing is the open source community has really stepped up and provided some really powerful models that you can run on-prem in your own data centers. Llama 3 is probably the most popular one, but there's many others. Even IBM open source their Granite models. So those are fully open source. I mean, there's probably hundreds of open source models out there today that you can get access to. Some of them are really powerful and would be competitive for a lot of use cases with these open source models. So that idea of like, we don't want to throw our data into some cloud environment and then it gets picked up and retrained and other people get to benefit from our data, and even worse, maybe get access to data that we don't want them to have access to or they shouldn't have access to, is a real concern. But also the idea that at some point in the future, you'll hear companies, big companies talk about, we're no longer a retail company, we're a tech company for retail. The next paradigm is like, we're no longer a retail company, we're no longer a manufacturing company. We're an AI company that does manufacturing. We're an AI company that does, that works in retail. So companies are going to be AI first. And that means the value that they're putting into their AI systems becomes proprietary IP. And if you're just dumping everything into an API call in the cloud, there's no IP. There's no secret sauce to your business. And you're just maybe keeping up with competitors at best.
That's wild. They've spent so much money going to the cloud. And now to think that every company is going to bring it all back in-house, kind of to their own data center.
Maybe not all back, but at least some of those workloads are going to come back into the data center. Probably not all of them, but some of them will.
That's wild.
Yeah.
And the different models are crazy too. And even if you just play with the top four or five, right? Gemini and, OpenAI and Grok and Anthropic, Claude, and that's all that's coming to mind. But you can ask all those the same question, and it's kind of wild to see the variation of the answers that you get. Some are better at some types of problems than others. Yeah. Like I get hot on Grok for a little while and then I'm like, wait a minute, this sucks. And then I throw it into Gemini. I'm like, okay, this is way better. I find myself switching between Grok and Gemini more than any of the other ones. Which ones do you prefer?
Yeah. So I use 3 right now for everything, like using stuff to like complete emails and stuff like that, PowerPoint creation. Of course, I'm using Copilot Plus. It's really great for that because it's integrated into applications. For personal stuff, helping write blogs or social media posts or like whatever kind of content creation or data summarization, doing research for things like if I'm going to write some piece of content or stuff for personal uses, I typically use ChatGPT. I think it's just because that's where I got started. I pay the $20 a month or whatever for the pro license. So it's easy enough. There's a lot of like really cool integrations. Like there's a keyboard integration for the phone. So people are like, oh, iPhone's going to integrate ChatGPT, which is cool. It's going to be much better than it is today. But like there was an app out there last year for a keyboard that you could just type in a prompt and it would automatically type something up for you, like a text message or whatever. So there's been some like tools to kind of hack the integration before. And I think a lot more of those exist for ChatGPT today. So some of those integrations are a little bit better. So that's probably why I use it. You can also plug it into things like Zapier. So there's like pre-built integrations for like Zapier and Excel and stuff like that. About being able to call GPT as a function in Excel is pretty cool. And then be able to push that stuff out to Zapier is pretty cool. So automating workflows. So like basically hacking agentic AI before it's really here. You can do that today by using some automation with your LLMs. Even at a personal level, you don't have to be a developer or an engineer. You can hack it together with Excel and Zapier and a couple other automation tools plugged into your favorite LLM. One of the apps, I haven't played around with it, but it looks really interesting, is U.com, which basically gives you access to all the different models They have like, I don't know, 5 or 6 models that, you know, are built into their front end. It looks pretty interesting. I haven't played around with it, but if you're using different models for different things, that one's pretty cool. One of the other ones that I've been playing around with is, of course, Llama, which we support in, we did an announcement at Lenovo last week at our Tech World event about this new application we're building called NewTalk, which is basically an enterprise-grade chat solution that you can plug in any LLM into. Of course, we've tested and validated with some of the common open source models like Llama. But it was really cool is then you can route with a tool like NewTalk, you can route your different prompts based off of the use case. So it's routing to the right model for that use case. And then also if you're using RAG architecture, that is routed to the right RAG for that use case, which is really cool. So if I'm doing, not that someone would be doing this, but if you're doing code development or if you have users that are doing more code development, some of the models are really good for code development. You want them using that model. Others are really good for content creation. So if you're doing more content, marketing content creation, you want to use a model and you want to use the RAG that's set up for that data set. Or if you're doing data mining for some like customer data, stuff like that, you want the model and you want the RAG that's set up for that. So it can be use case specific and kind of preset this based off of different use cases for the model, the RAG, and all of that. So yeah, I've been playing around with that. It's a really powerful application because I think that's what a lot of people are looking for is they play around with stuff like ChatGPT online for personal use. And they're like, this would be awesome to be able to use for my company. But then there's a sensitivity around putting company data into something like ChatGPT. And so that's why we designed this NewTalk platform, is to solve for that problem.
Interesting. I keep seeing the term RAG, and I don't quite understand it yet, but I think by how you were describing it, is it like the quarterback or the point guard? Is it the one that's kind of orchestrating and deciding which model gets what question and then presenting it back to you?
I would say if you're going to use a football, American football analogy, the quarterback is a good one of like, you get to make some choices on your route and like of how you're going to run the play. So I think that's probably the best analogy for it. And if you think about it like this, like, all right, large language models are trained on a data set and you don't know what that data set is unless they tell you what it is, unless they expose the data set. And some of the open source models do, they tell you exactly what data set it's trained on. Some of them even open source the data sets, right? But for the most part, you're using ChatGPT, you just know that it was trained on some data, right? Internet scale data, which means they probably scraped a lot of data online to train this model. Some of it may be related to your business, some of it may not be. So it's basically using like all data on the internet. And so it's not really focused, right? It's not really focused on the use case that you're talking to it about. So if you ask it something, I'll use a Lenovo example. Say I'm a marketing manager and I'm trying to create some new technical content around a product. Like I need to create a product guide, some charts, for a new launch, for a new product. ChatGPT doesn't have knowledge of my product, so it's going to give me a lot of generic stuff. Maybe it's got some Lenovo context, but it's going to give me a lot of generic stuff. And also, it opens up the door for if it doesn't know, if it doesn't have that data and its trained data set, it's going to hallucinate, it's going to make something up. It has to give you a response unless you have guardrails in place to tell it otherwise. It's going to give you a response even if that is not accurate or untrue. And we saw that with Gemini, right? When Gemini launched, they were telling people to put glue on their pizza to make it better. And it's because it was a joke that somebody put on Reddit, but it didn't have the context to know that someone was being sarcastic on Reddit.
Right.
That's not good instruction. Basically, what RAG architecture means is we can start contextualizing the response based off of very specific data input. And actually, ChatGPT did migrate to RAG architecture. And what that means is it's running essentially like a little search engine ahead of the model. The model's really good at writing creative content and summarizing content, but you need to point it in the right direction. And so what that does is it's basically putting a vector search on a certain data set in front of the LLM to say, don't look at everything on the internet, focus on these 3 articles and then give me a response. So that's why you have these little source links in ChatGPT now. At the bottom it says, it'll give you like 3 links to articles, a Wikipedia page, some blog. That's what the vector search found. It inputs those sources in. And so in a business context, you want that vector search pointed at maybe internal data, maybe a knowledge base somewhere. Which is really cool because you can take an open source model. You don't have to retrain it, fine-tune it. You don't have to build your own model. You take Llama 3, you put it after a vector search, point that vector search at your knowledge base, and now you have a tailored generative AI solution that's specific to your business data, the information that you want to summarize or that you want to pull from, drive insights from. That's awesome. And that's something you don't have to have a data science team to do that. So RAG architecture is really how most organizations are getting started, by using RAG architecture with an open source LLM.
Interesting. Yeah. And the new thing that we were going to chat about, you mentioned something in our prep call called agentic AI. Yeah. And I follow Daniel Meisler's podcast and his newsletter. I'm not sure if you ever heard of it. It's called Unsupervised Learning. And I feel like he's on the forefront of all this stuff. Like, that's where I get most of my AI news from. And he's been talking about people having AI agents for quite a while, or maybe multiple AI agents that kind of work on your behalf. It's going to be wild, man. I guess, how do you see this playing out? When will people actually have on their phone an AI agent?
Well, it's funny that you say on your phone, because one of the things that we showcased, we actually launched a beta AI agent on Moto phones last week at Tech World. So if can get into the beta program, you can get an AI agent. It's limited to certain types of use cases. And it's version one. It's not even version one. It's the beta version that we released on our Motorola devices. It's here. It's very in its infancy stage. It's just going to keep getting better. And we're going to see more like commercialized offerings over the next year to, you know, I would say 12 to 18 months is really when we start seeing AI agents, you know, become as prevalent as maybe LLM and generative AI is. And basically, for people that aren't following along with what we're talking about, we're actually talking about taking it a step farther than an LLM. An LLM today, you provide some, what we call a prompt or some question or input, and it gives you a response. It creates something new, generates something new from all of the knowledge that it's been trained on. But that doesn't automate a task for you. So if you have more of an abstract task, for example, common workflow, if you're using that to write some marketing content, you're going to prompt it on some different things to try to do some ideation, right? You're going to say, look, I'm a marketing manager for, let's say it's for some AI SaaS software for recruiting, right? And we want to write some new blog posts about this. So you can start prompting it to say, give me an outline. Okay, we got an outline. We refine it a little bit. You prompt it for something else. But you got to keep this back and forth going to really get to a refined state of what you really want. Using a Gen AI app today is like having a really smart intern, right? Your instructions have to be very specific, and you got to keep giving them more instructions and keep giving more instructions. And eventually you get the product you want. But it's not like having a seasoned person on your team, engineer, or a staff member on your team, where you just give them a concept of what you need and then they go figure it out, right? That's the difference between moving from an LLM or generative AI into agentic AI, is that you can use more abstract concepts, and even that there's a feedback loop that these agents will start to learn the nuances of your behavior and start to be able to act on your behalf is really the future state of it. But really what we're talking about in the first phase is being able to do more automation and automate tasks and kind of work on your behalf with, you know, an instruction that's maybe more abstract, and you're not having this back and forth with these AI systems.
Yeah, I'm not a Zapier expert. Like, I might have to pick your brain about that later. And I know of Zapier. I know what it does. Like, you can integrate all kinds of apps, but I haven't taken advantage of it and tinkered with it and plugged it into a LLM and, you know, integrated it with any APIs. That's just not, I haven't gone that far, and maybe I should, maybe that's my problem, but I feel like I might dump a lot of time into building something like that. And then by the time I've actually got it built and I'm proud of it, I could have just waited for the agent and it would have done it. So that was a waste of time.
I think sometimes it helps you, you know, if you've got something that's repetitive, it can be really cool, you know. Will there be an agent that comes out that automates it? It depends. It depends on what you're using it for. You know, I imagine that a lot of like enterprise applications are going to have agentic AI modules. But just as you see today, like, not all of them are great. Some of them are doing it well and some of them are not. So I find that it, once you kind of figure it out, and honestly, like, some of the instructions that you build in to create these workflows are copy and paste once you do them once, that you can use them for other workflows. So I found that it's really cool for being able to kind of automate some of these like interactions with LLMs. And when I started using it, is when I transitioned from being more of a, you know, opportunistic user. Like, I had ChatGPT subscription. I signed up for it when it came out, you know, got on the wait list, all that good stuff. I'd play around with it time to time, or like if I needed to write an email or write some content, maybe I would prompt some stuff into ChatGPT, but I didn't use it every day. But when you start using it more and more in your workflow and you kind of understand what it's really good at, then you're like, how do I get away from having to interface with this thing and just write a bunch of prompts? Like, I could just tell it a lot about myself. You know, essentially you can create a RAG architecture with Excel. And that's essentially what I've done for some of my stuff, where I just give it a lot of information instead of having to tell it every time the background. I give it all my background and I say, based off of this information about me, I want you to write something on this topic for this type of output. And I have those rules set up in Excel and just could plug stuff into it and just kind of churn out a lot of different content, which is really cool. That's one of the ways I use it. And I found that using some automation tools are really beneficial.
Yeah, content creation is like, oh man, it's I got a love-hate relationship with it, because I'm like, all right, what am I going to present today to the internet? What am I going to bring to show and tell today? Do I have anything? One good thing about podcasting is you can use some clips every once in a while. You can't use it every day. Most of the time, the best ideas I get, they'll just pop into my mind randomly. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to make that real quick. You know, a little video. Also, you know, just scrolling through social media, you'll see something else and it'll give you an idea, or you'll kind of copy it and put your own little twist on it or whatever. So I'm just worried about whenever most of your feed is AI generated on either LinkedIn or wherever, right? YouTube videos, if it's all AI generated, I'm just going to stop watching it. Like, I don't want to look at it. I really don't. Like, if it's all AI, I want to watch what humans are actually writing and creating. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about that is I think like there's going to be this kind of like push and pull on utilization of AI. The first thing is like more people start using it and start using it for content creation, you're just going to get a flood of AI generated content out there. I really don't care if someone used AI. I just read a book. Actually, it's called The Hitchhiker's Guide to AI.
And oh, cool.
The author, I actually got to meet him last week. He came out to our event and did an interview with him, and really interesting conversation that we had. But he uses, and he's open and honest with it. He's like, this is what I used it for in the book. So as he's like writing the book, he's telling you how he's using AI to help him write the book. And really, there's this kind of like spectrum of AI as an assistant, you know, helping you out with some ideas and concepts, or rewriting content. So it's using it as an assistant. On the other end is like full AI is writing the whole thing and creating all the content. And I think the really interesting content that you're going to see out there is probably going to, everyone's going to use AI in some way to help them create content, whether it's through the kind of ideation process of like coming up with new concepts of what to talk about or what to write about and how to conceptualize that to the right format, to just people that are just going to be pumping out trash content, right? And just kind of like pushing out a bunch of different stuff. What's interesting about that is I don't care how much he used AI to write this book. What I care is that the content was beneficial to me. It was interesting to me. And I think that's really the quality value of content is going to be really, really important. So I think of it like the Amazon model, the marketplace model, where we're going to have to start rating content. Not that it was AI generated or not AI generated. That's a whole thing. Like, yeah, if you're using AI to generate content, you should probably like disclose and, you know, make people aware that it's AI generated. And I think that's about, you know, that whole kind of concept of responsible AI and acting in an ethical and responsible way. The other aspect of it is we're going to have some grading system on the quality of content, because content marketing, for example, when that was really popular, you know, about 10 years ago or so, there was a lot of companies out there creating trash content that wasn't very valuable, you know, and so it became noise. And I think the same thing is now you're just giving people a megaphone to create some good stuff, but some trash content. So we're going to have some way to better filter and great content on the quality of it that creates some type of filtering mechanism. I'm getting overwhelmed. I'm already overwhelmed.
Right.
With stuff coming at me on social media, on the news, on everything else. I need an AI agent to filter out some of the noise and just give me the most relevant stuff. I mean, even like on the topic of AI, there's so much content about new stuff coming out every day. Like I use TLDR to even keep up with it. That's the only way I can keep up with everything that's happening. 5-minute, 10-minute read each morning. And then some people that I follow on like LinkedIn and other social media platforms that are, you know, pretty good about, you know, sometimes it's who you follow, you know, they're going to summarize some of the top content for you. We actually had Allie Miller was on stage with us at Tech World. And so she's one of the, I would say, thought leaders in the space. And there's quite a few others, Andrew Ng, lots of other really good thought leaders out there that I follow on social media that kind of disseminate, you know, some of the, I would say, most interesting AI content. But there's going to be a challenge in the industry that people are going to want better systems for filtering out what they consume. Algorithms, right, and agents that help do that.
Yeah, you'll have an agent just to filter through all the noise and give you what it thinks that you want. And I wonder what it's going to try to feed me. Probably just a bunch of memes and Star Wars memes.
I was talking to someone the other day, and they were talking about this concept of, we went from like creating content that was for consumption to creating content that was for search engines. So everyone like in the mid-2000s shifted to SEO focus, right? Now we're going to get to a point where I'm not going to go Google something. I'm not going to go use a search engine for something. I'm going to ask my agent, my assistant, to summarize something for me, or what's the latest news happening in AI today. That's the type of thing we're going to use agents for. SEO is going to be dead, right? It's going to be, how do I make sure that more of my content shows up in their algorithms and their AI algorithms and their Gen AI or agentic AI models? That's going to be the name of the game moving forward.
Wild. Let's dive into what are some of the main problems that you're working on solving right now?
There's a lot of hype and noise and interest in generative AI. Everyone's like, okay, it popped in 2023. A lot of people play around with it. And then it's going to go through a quick hype curve. And what's interesting is we're seeing like sustained interest. So I don't think the hype curve is dipping yet. There's still a lot of interest, but the interest is shifting from, oh, that's a cool science project. And it's shifting from an art of possible discussion to an art of practical discussion for a lot of enterprise organizations. And so it's moving from like, okay, you showed me a lot of cool demos and how AI can be used. Now let's get into, for my business, give me something that I can go build a business case around. Show me how it can be used in a way that helps me solve some business challenges. And I think that's really been the focus of this year, 24, moving into 25, is we're seeing enterprises go from interest, high level of interest, you know, still the number one priority for CIOs, according to our latest CIO survey at Lenovo. There's still a slow start for enterprise organizations, but they need help. They need help with taking it from art of possible into like, let's build a business case. Let's pick our top use cases. Let's do a fast POC. We need to show value really quickly or prove out that this is something we should spend time on, because the market is moving so fast. The days of spending months and years and testing out some piece of software before you roll it out and doing these long drawn out POCs is gone. If you were testing out some digital assistant, we saw a lot of these in like help desk and call center support and stuff like that, where they're having these little agents that you could, you type requests into. If you implemented one of those a few years ago, pre-Gen AI boom, they were based on small language models, older legacy models, and they could probably do like 5 things really well, but they were not really automating a tier one support. If you have a modern one that's based on an LLM, we're seeing customers that are like automating their tier one support. You're able to solve a lot of your tier one challenges with an agent. Just think of how quickly that happened, how quickly these service agents, how quickly they were turned into legacy products, like almost like overnight. And so if you spent the last 2 years testing one and trying to roll it out, you're already in technical debt at this point, right? It's time to start over, because now you have Gen AI and whatever you just rolled out is obsolete, which is pretty crazy to think about how quickly this market's moving. So it's about really fast time to value, proving things out really quickly. And so a lot of the services that we're developing at Lenovo are really based around that, like getting people AI ready, quickly identifying use cases, quickly getting them through proof of value within a matter of weeks to at the most matter of months. They can quickly make a decision around, this is a go, no go. So that's really where the market's at today.
Yeah, getting past those committees, right? The bureaucracy. If you're a big company, it's hard to do anything, much less like anything that might be risky, that might come with some concerns from, you know, from the cybersecurity department, the ethics of it all. And, you know, what's this going to do to jobs and how's the market going to perceive this? You were telling me Lenovo has a committee for that, like a responsible AI committee. What are some of the things that you guys are chatting about? Like what comes up every day?
Yeah, so this is something that we actually built a few years ago. Or we started on a few years ago. We didn't, I think, fully grasp how important it was going to be when we started on this journey, but we knew we needed some checks and balances. So the practical things that we ran into is you basically have product managers that were either looking at certain types of AI tools that they were going to embed in their product, or even internal teams that were like, we want to do visual inspection on our manufacturing assembly line. And really it was like the gap was at that time that a lot of these decision makers had no real competency around AI, around the tools, around how the models were developed. And so they basically looked at the outcome. Does it solve the problem, the business problem, without looking at the process of how it does it and being able to unpack, you know, is this really the technology we want to get behind? And so we saw this like train coming early on. And so a few years ago, we stood up our responsible AI committee at Lenovo, and we have members from legal, from cybersecurity team, from different parts of the business that actually participate in it. And essentially we look at it from whether it's something we're going to use internally in Lenovo, whether it's something that we're going to build into a product, whether it's software or technology that we're developing, or maybe it's third-party software that we're going to turn into a solution like our AI innovators partners, we take them through a responsible AI review. So we're looking at things like diversity and inclusion. That's one element of it. You know, are people using balanced data sets that are going to provide a balanced output? Or you've got organizations that have had issues with like using AI systems, but the data was only trained on one demographic of people or overtrained on one demographic of people. And so it really doesn't work for all people. It's not well represented of all individuals in their organization. And so there's issues like that. Privacy and security. Are you opening up any, not just your base level of cybersecurity, but are you opening up an incremental risk by using AI? Are these models well designed and robust enough to protect against things like model poisoning and things like that? And so there's like other elements of cybersecurity you need to think through. Accountability and reliability of the systems, explainability and transparency. Can we explain why the model does what it does? And can we expose enough to the right stakeholders so they can understand? Because people are going to be held accountable for what some of these AI systems do on their behalf, right? So they need to be able to understand, maybe not a data science, PhD data scientist level, but they need to be able to understand how these systems work, why it gives certain responses, what are the capabilities, but also what are the limitations of some of these systems. And then we have things like environmental and social impact. If you look at generative AI, I think the last stat that I saw, generative AI is going to consume more power, more electricity than the 14th largest nation in the world in the next 2 years. That's crazy.
That is crazy.
That's crazy to think about. Google, and I think there's another CSP provider, they're building nuclear power plants for their Gen AI solutions and their agentic AI solutions, right? Everyone that's like really heavily invested into it, they're like, we've got to go back and relook at our net zero commitments because I don't think we're going to make those with using AI. So you've basically got people's sustainability goals and objectives are at odds with their AI ambitions. And that's a big problem right now. One of the things that we did at Lenovo over the past few years, we've invested a lot into liquid cooling for our high-performance computing customers. Now we're bringing that into these like AI systems because just by using liquid cooling, warm water liquid cooling, you can save up to 40% of your power. And there's also like the business value of that, of like I'm wasting 40% of my investment on just the environmental factors of our data center, keeping the systems cool. We want to spend more of that investment on more performance or trying to balance our sustainability goals and our AI ambitions. The other thing that's going to be an impact too, we talked about this earlier, but MPUs on devices, right? That's much more efficient silicon for certain types of workloads. So the other trend that I think is going to happen is using more efficient silicon. A, does every problem need AI? And the answer is no. Some use cases don't need AI. Some don't need deep learning. Some can use small language models instead of large language models. You know, that's a trend we're seeing too. Okay, once you've done RAG architecture, you're proving out your business case. Well, if you want to get that running on more efficient compute or reduce the size of your compute down or support more users, well, you could take a SLM, a 7 billion parameter model, retrain it on that data, get the same output as that large language model with RAG architecture. You maybe instead of supporting 10 users, you're supporting 50 users per GPU or something like that. So using more efficient silicon, using the right models for the right use cases. I think that's some of the sophistication that's got to happen for people to become more efficient at their AI deployments. A lot of people are just, I think, version one, going out buying the biggest, baddest systems and trying to throw the largest models they can at a problem. But the natural refinement is, you know, we have cost factors, we have environmental factors, and so we have to refine our AI deployments and our sophistication around our buying decisions by looking at price efficiency, price performance, performance efficiency of the infrastructure, looking at the right models for the right use cases, and then looking at more efficient infrastructure, whether it's using liquid cooling or maybe it's using more efficient silicon that's going to bring down the power consumption.
I saw a couple videos of the liquid cooled. I mean, I'm talking fully submerged chipsets. What is the liquid? What is it made of?
So those systems usually use like a glycol based. It's essentially like baby oil.
I love that shit.
Are you serious?
Don't smile like that.
That was a joke.
It's no time to joke.
Allows you to use liquid without shorting out the system, right? But there are submersion systems in glycol. We have some partners that do that. They take some of our systems and put them in these submersion tanks or these submersion rack units. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is by using cold plates, like copper cold plates. So instead of like having a big heat sink on the chip, you put this really small cold plate, but then you're running water through that cold plate. So essentially you're transferring the heat to water via a cold plate, and then you're running basically a water loop through the system. That's actually the way a lot of the gaming PCs do it today. If you have liquid cooled components in your gaming PC, a lot of them use a cold plate to extract heat from the processor, and then they'll use like a big kind of like radiator in the PC. Essentially, you blow that up to an enterprise system. We're doing the same thing essentially. On the servers, we're running liquid cooled loops through the server, and we're putting cool plates on everything, not just the GPUs. That's about 50-60% of the power consumption of the box, maybe a little bit more. But then the CPUs, the memory, the every component in there. In our latest generation, we even put it on the power supply. So these things are completely fanless, no fans in the server. It's quiet. You go into one of these liquid cooled data centers, racks of systems, no ear protection. You can hear a pin drop, which is really wild. And then also when you're around the systems, like if you're in a regular data center, these things are putting out a lot of heat. You're in a liquid cooled data center, it's cool. There's no air conditioning, really wild. And then when you're using warm water instead of glycol, A, it's just easier to work with. You don't have to have any special tooling like one of these submersion tanks, like what you're talking about. It's a lot easier for enterprise IT administrators to work with these systems. I mean, we've designed it to go into an enterprise environment with the tooling that they have today. So they look like a server from the front end. You go around the back and there's this manifold, this water loop manifold. When you pull that server out, dripless disconnects on it, no water leaking everywhere. And it looks like a server with a bunch of like copper tubes going through it, which is really cool because it allows some serviceability without having, you know, all the tooling that you have with submersion systems like what you mentioned. But also what you get to do with that, water is a lot easier to work with than glycol, but also you get to reuse it for other things, right? So your water reuse, there's even the story of this university that has a warm water cooled supercomputer, and they use the water to then heat the swimming pool for the university, which is really, a really creative way to do it. But there's all kinds of things you can do. Put it back into your building system. You can use the heat from the water to do other things. So there's really cool ways that you can use it if you go down the warm water cooling path instead of something like a glycol-based system.
Wow. Did we just jump in time? Is it already 2 o'clock?
We've blown through it, man. It's exciting. I think we've covered a lot of ground today. We're all over the place, man. People are going to be like, man, I wish they'd focus a little bit on the discussion. But No, it's been a really fun conversation, Blake.
It has. Yeah. Thanks for coming on. I know you got to run. I hope we get around too, because I wanted to chat with you about, you know, the impact on jobs and recruiting and all that stuff. But I looked at the clock and wow, I feel like we just hit fast forward. So yeah, fun talking with you. Thanks for coming on and hope we can do it again. I'll follow up with you after.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on, Blake. Excited to come back and do a deep dive on those topics too, because I've got a lot of thoughts on that subject as well.
All right. Part one.
Thanks,
Blake. Good to have you.
Yeah,
take care. Have a good Friday. Have a good weekend.
You too. Take care.